Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
All right, welcome everybody to the Lakers Legacy Podcast, where we are now officially in the doggiest days of the NBA summer, where fans are starting to microanalyze the 26 straight threes they just saw Jalen Hood-Schifino hit in a summer workout video, or carefully trying to decipher whether Steph Curry changing the description on his Instagram profile to leave out the Golden State Warriors means anything for his future prospects in the Bay. Whatever the case may be, welcome to the Lakers, Steph Curry. Or Jalen Hood Chef Eno, as I like to call him, because, you know, he's the chef. Anyways, I am your host, Jonathan Hernandez, and speaking of Jalen Hood-Schifino's summer workout videos, today we are beyond thrilled to be joined by one of JHS's most ardent supporters and believers, a man who needs no introduction in the Lakers Twitter sphere, Mr. Raj Jhapalu. Raj, this has been a long time coming, but welcome to the Lakers Legacy Podcast. Thank you for joining us today and helping us try to get through this final week of August.
Oh man, it's awesome to, you know, finally be on this show. I was telling you, Jonathan, before I came on, your pod was one of the first Laker podcasts that, like, when I found out what podcasts were that I would listen to. And you know this, just being in the space, once you start doing this, it's tough to follow every Laker pod. But, like, definitely when I was in college and during the D'Angelo Russell days and the Luke Walton days, my drive to school was always just a Lakers Legacy pod, because I know you guys would upload, which, like, you were super consistent after every game. Some of my favorite, you know, I remember D'Lo drop. I don't know if you remember this, but it was a preseason after D'Lo's rookie year. So it was like Luke's first time coaching. And D'Lo, I think, dropped like 32 on the Sacramento Kings in preseason. And the first thing I wanted to hear was like the Lakers Legacy guys talk about D'Lo. And obviously he had a very, terrible national reputation. But it's awesome to be here, man, and a long time coming.
Well, time is a flat circle, because here we are again talking about D'Angelo Russell and trying to contextualize his game. But Raj, it has been a pleasure and joy to watch your own ascension in the Lakers Nation social media space. I think you represent the best out of all of us. There's a lot of characters in the Lakers space, podcasters, beat writers, etc. But I think genuinely you represent the best out of all of us in terms of a hungry, hard worker, and someone who's a student of the game. And most importantly, someone who's typically very level-headed and measured in your takes and always tries to properly contextualize the situation before jumping to the clickbaity conclusion. So I am privileged to finally have you on the show to have some well-balanced discussions on the Lakers. So for today's episode, Raj, I just wanted to do like a mixable mashup of some of the most prevalent discussions that have been swirling around the Lakers this offseason, and get your thoughts on where you stand on most things now, if it's changed during the course of the summer, as we prime our way through to the start of training camp. But first, let's start off with a fun question. Usually podcasts don't start off with like, what's your hot take? But I'm going to do it. So here we go. I asked you to sort of prepare this beforehand, but what is a quote unquote hot take you have about next season, whether it's about a particular aspect of the team in general or a particular player or lineup, one that you feel pretty strongly about that's a little off the beaten path and hasn't been embraced by the consensus? So some examples would be Jaxson Hayes should start next to Anthony Davis, or Anthony Davis needs more post-ups. So give me your hottest take of the offseason that you're currently workshopping.
Yeah, so definitely have a few, and I like one of the examples you gave me was bring D'Lo off the bench, which I think just cannot, you know, happen. But I, you know, so, you know, Lakers Summer League has kind of gotten mixed reviews when people watch. The Lakers weren't, you know, winning, and their Summer League coach got actually fired after coaching them. That's how kind of terrible the offense is. But Jonathan, I'm very, very high on Dalton Connect, and I think Laker fans will be too. I think it's going to get to a point where they're going to ask if he should start. And what it reminds me of, do you go to Summer League, by the way, Jonathan? Do you make it out there?
I did like the first, I think from D'Lo's year on to like Lonzo's year, I did consistently, but it's been a little bit okay. More sporadic recently, but yeah.
Okay. So that's like a trip I make every year. And I was there for the Lonzo year. And this is at this time, I wasn't really covering basketball in this way. For an example, I had no idea who Kyle Kuzma was, you know, so I did not follow the draft at all. I just, you know, I watched that first game and Lonzo struggled against the Celtics and Kuzma had like 32. I was like, man, who is this guy? But he could score an array of ways, right? He had floaters. His jump shot looked pure. And again, this is all in the Summer League context. So it's tough to kind of, you know, put that into the league. But I think Dalton Connect's skills just kind of match what, you know, the team has with, you know, AD as a screener, LeBron as a passer. And his coach is freaking JJ Redick. And I feel like coaches kind of really uplift players they see themselves in. And it's kind of why I believe Darvin Ham really love Torian Prince, love Cam Reddish, right? Love Patrick Beverley, love these kind of scrappy type players that really reminded him of himself. I think JJ is going to see similar things with Dalton Connect. So I'm very high on Connect. He averaged around 22 a game in the Las Vegas games. The offense was terrible. I hated what they were running. There was no, you know, semblance of an offense. The defense was awful as well. There was no point guard. My guy Jalen Huchefino was out for the summer league, and I wish he played because I'm already seeing things like people, you know, real people telling me Bronny James is already better than Jalen Huchefino. I would like to just slow those kind of conversations down. But I'm very high on Dalton Connect. So that's my first one. Are you in the same kind of boat with him, or how do you feel about him?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. If you really want to make your take even hotter, Raj, you would say something like, you know, I'm so high on Dalton that at some point mid-season, I think the Lakers may find Austin Reeves expendable and maybe put him in a trade package for somebody else, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not going to put those words into your mouth. But what I will say is, yes, I am also very high on Dalton Connect just because what he did in Summer League kind of shows you both his ceiling and his floor. You saw the floor with regards to the off-ball play and just his instinctual cuts to the basket from Colin Castleton and the way that he'd run off of the screen and just take a one dribble pull-up for an easy jump shot. And then you saw the ceiling with regards to, okay, here's a guy guarding him and he has to sort of absorb the physicality of NBA players, but he's still able to get this ridiculous fadeaway one-footed, one-legged Dirk shot and hit it, you know? And he has just sort of like a, I think the thing that impressed me the most about his summer league was just like his mental toughness and relentlessness, because he did not have a good California Classic before Vegas in terms of his field goal percentage, but he kind of just kept trusting his game and his ability to find his spots. And those shots eventually started falling in Vegas when he consistently started scoring, you know, 22 points on higher efficiency. So yeah, I totally agree with you. I am on board the Dalton Connect train. My hot take though, I don't even know if this is a hot take, but when it comes to solely talking about on-court basketball production in a vacuum, my quote unquote hot take, or something that I haven't seen talked about too much, is next season, I think the most effective backcourt pairing for the Lakers is not necessarily AR and D'Lo. I think most people are off that bandwagon when it comes to the playoffs. I also don't think it's necessarily Austin Reaves and Gabe Vincent. I don't think it's D'Angelo Russell and Gabe Vincent. And I also don't think it's Austin Reaves and Max Christie. I think the Lakers' most effective backcourt pairing is actually D'Angelo Russell and Max Christie. Now, I am not pushing for them to start, but I am pushing for them to get more minutes with one another. And if there was ever a non-AR and D'Lo backcourt that should start, I think it should be D'Angelo Russell and Max Christie. Now, there are obvious reasons why you wouldn't do that, because the Lakers don't seem long for D'Angelo Russell, so they'd probably still start Max Christie and Austin Reaves first. But I'm just talking about on-court. I'm just talking about an on-court basketball vacuum. From what we've seen of D'Angelo and Max Christie, especially last season, when I believe, according to Cleaning the Glass, the backcourt of D'Lo, Max Christie, was the second highest overall point differential five-man lineup on the Lakers. And you actually saw that on the court play out as well. And here's the reason why I think that works so well. One, obviously, Max Christie sort of fills in for D'Lo's defensive deficiencies. But then D'Angelo Russell also fills in for Max Christie's lack of on-ball ability as well. And I'm not even saying Austin Reaves and Max Christie don't work well. I think they do. I just think the D'Angelo Russell-Max Christie backcourt pairing works better because D'Lo is the better floor general and overall playmaker than Austin is. So D'Lo and Max kind of help each other in, like, perfectly fill in the gaps of each other's games. So that's that. I don't even know if that's a hot take, but it's just one that, like, I've seen it. I've seen some people say, like, no, Austin Reaves and Max Christie should be the starting, you know, backcourt. And while, again, I think that would work out fine, I just think there's a better pairing that the Lakers should also explore if D'Angelo Russell is still on the team. So any thoughts on that quote unquote hot take?
Right. No, so I think you're definitely in the camp where, you know, I think most of Laker fans are very high on Max Christie. Like, I saw John Hollinger kind of tweet his stats about Max Christie and call him, you know, one of the worst, I think, bench players, or couldn't even get on the court from one of the worst benches in the league. He was actually on one of my hot takes, Jonathan, which is I have no idea how good Max Christie is like that. And that's such a waste from last season to me, because we spent so much time trying to figure out if Cam Reddish was still an NBA player. And I think we just wasted a lot of those minutes, where I think Max, he had some legit, really good defensive games. The game in Cleveland where they put him on Donovan Mitchell and he stayed in front. I called Max our best fundamental, technically sound defender, right? He's not a best defender on team that goes to AD. I think Vando's probably a little bit better than him just on the perimeter, but Max is just so fundamentally sound. He always closes out with the correct hand. He's always, you know, on balance. When he gets blown by, he still kind of contests from behind, but the jump shot still is up and down, right? I have no idea if he can shoot. And like the third starter, which will be, you know, later on, you know, in this discussion, if you have a guy like Vando out there, I just worry about the offense. But I like that pairing. I would like to see it more. It's still insane to me that D'Angelo Russell is on this team. Like, I think it's such an insane thing to look at, and we're still diving into his game and a whole nother season of, he had 8 threes tonight, but, you know, you're going to remember the playoffs, which for how they went. But I like that backcourt. I think Austin's going to continue to start. We'll see how, you know, it goes. And yeah, you just can't invest in D'Lo in this way, which makes this season very confusing to me that we, you know, brought D'Lo back. And you talked about D'Lo's not long for this team. Is he not long for this team? I mean, are you going to go and trade him? Are you going to again put D'Lo up onto the trade deadline, you know, sign like, hey, he's available again after you try to trade him all summer? So it's just fascinating to look how the team goes. But I'm high on Max Christie. I just have no idea what he is. I think that contract is perfectly fine. I think the defense stuff is legit. I think the, like, one dribble pull up is the thing he's comfortable at. He's not hitting it at an efficient level yet. There's some pick and roll skills that need to be improved. There's some pick and roll reads that need to be improved that can only really be improved, Jonathan, through reps, which again makes last season so. I remember during the play-in as well, like my favorite game maybe of the season was you know, against Indiana in the play-in game, where like we had Max, Vando, and a good Cam Reddish, right? The Cam Reddish that was focused on defense and flying around and doing the right stuff, and we looked like a problem on that end with AD as well. But yeah, I'm high on Max. I'm not as high, I think, as consensus as, you know, Lakers Twitter is, but I'm excited to see him absolutely get rotation minutes.
For sure. And that is the most frustrating part about last season. And, you know, it's not even necessarily about Cam Reddish versus Max Christie, because as you pointed out, there were lineups out there where they were both on the court at the same time, wreaking havoc. And I was like, wow, think of the possibilities. But then you have to worry about Torian Prince getting 30 minutes a night all of a sudden. Or the biggest problem with Cam Reddish was I don't think Darvin Ham adequately assessed how healthy this guy was every time that he'd come back. And he would kind of still continue to pigeonhole Cam Reddish into the same, you know, Cam Reddish in November when he was fully healthy without realizing, actually, this guy's pretty banged up still. And maybe I overexhausted him in November, but I'm still playing him 30 minutes in December and January when clearly he was in and out of the lineup because he couldn't get himself right health-wise. So at that point, the fact that Max Christie still wasn't getting consistent run, I think, is the most frustrating part about his entire year, because you could look back on November and say, actually, the Lakers needed what Cam Reddish gave them that month. But it was the forthcoming poor assessments of who Cam Reddish was, even health-wise, that kind of derailed the season. Now, you just mentioned D'Angelo Russell still being here and the strange offseason the Lakers have been in, which is a perfect segue into, well, actually, before we get into the awkwardness of the offseason, I want to start off with something positive. What have your thoughts been on JJ Redick and how he's been running offseason workouts into training camp? Are you encouraged by some of the news out of the Lakers facility about the ways Redick is, you know, handling practices and offseason workouts, even with like Exhibit 10 players, you know, and having more actual one-on-one, three-on-three basketball work to actually simulate real game situations? Like, this stuff seems pretty straightforward and they sound like things that, you know, this team should have always been doing under Darvin Ham, but it sounds like Redick wants to take things back to the basics and make sure that all of these guys, even Exhibit 10 guys, all the way up to the starters, that these guys have rhythm through actual reps and not just, you know, film room concept-based knowledge. Yeah. And I think when you pointed out the fact that the Lakers fired their Summer League head coach and some of their staff, you know, it sucks. It always sucks when someone loses their job. But I do think that it is indicative of the sort of culture they're trying to build around JJ Redick, where, hey, if you're not good enough and you're not cutting it, you got to go. So any thoughts about JJ Redick and how things are starting to sort of shape up this offseason?
Jonathan, I wanted him coaching Summer League. Like, I know people think it doesn't matter. I think it does. You had, again, I'm high on Dante Kinnick, and I, you know, thought he had a chance at the rotation when he was drafted. That's a guy that could be in rotation. Bronny James is on the team. Colin Castleton was a center that they were thinking could play. I wanted him coaching in the Summer League, and I actually like Coach Dane. Like, I thought he had a fine year in the G League. I know most people aren't following the G League, but it's why I was, you know, tweeting out clips from the Summer League, and, you know, people are telling me it doesn't matter. I was like, look, this is not organized basketball. Like, I understand the other team looks like they practiced five times, and we look like we met each other before we played. Like, and so I understand why he was kind of let go, but I'm glad to see JJ's already in there. I mean, usually first time head coaches are very hands-on, right? Usually they're excited to kind of get in the building and meet the players, and whether it's Exhibit 10 players or whether it's roster players. And as the summer goes on, you'll see more and more players kind of get into the gym. But JJ, to me, and I said this when he was hired, and I said this actually when he was even in contention, he's a basketball psycho. You know, his podcast gets the jokes for what it is, but you could just tell how prepared that guy is when he, you know, speaks. He's not just going and blabbering or, you know, having just telling stories. He's like really breaking down the game. And I think that's how you get a podcast with LeBron, and players kind of open up to him in kind of a different way than they do other podcasts. They open up to him in an X's and O's perspective of breaking down kind of what's going on. Shooters come on there, right? Cam Johnson, like, really breaking down the shooting mechanics. That dude's a basketball psycho. And you can kind of tell with the way he speaks. And I thought his press conference kind of embodied that as well. But it's good to see he's in there and kind of running plays. I don't really believe he was running plays. He was drawing up plays for Dante Kinnick when he was drafted. I think that was a little bit of Rob Pelinka selling the story as he does. But no, it's cool to see JJ, you know, already in there and kind of organizing practices and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's awesome to see him put everything that he says into like literal practice and see him sort of grinding even now. We had a Quincy Oliveri, who's like an Exhibit 10 training camp invite, on the podcast last episode, and he was talking about how, you know, J.J. Redick, he had some questions for J.J. Redick about footwork coming off screens and how open Redick was to just sitting down and talking with him over those basics. You'd think, oh, J.J. Redick's so busy, why would he talk to an Exhibit 10 player? But just the fact that, you know, he is treating everyone the same way and he's putting emphasis on every player, regardless of how inconsequential you think said player is, right? Or how inconsequential you think this one training session is. It really sounds like, and it makes sense, right? Because this is a guy with a huge chip on his shoulder because of the awkward way that he got to this position as head coach. I don't think J.J. Redick wants to be the butt of jokes this upcoming season. I don't think he wants to hear people calling him Coach Podcast. And so I think he's coming in with a real chip on his shoulder this season and attacking things the way he's always attacked things as a player, with tremendous detail, precision, and hard work. And I think he also naturally already possesses this innate rapport with the Lakers players because he's either played against most of them just 3 years ago during his NBA career, or he was actually teammates with some of them, or he's had them on his podcast before. You know, I was listening to his podcast with Austin Reeves and D'Angelo Russell, and like, they legitimately look up to him like a big brother. And this was during the time he was still playing. And so I can only imagine how, you know, with Darvin Ham, I'm sure at the start he maybe commanded some respect, but I feel like there was probably always this sort of, because of the generational divide as well, there was probably always a wall between him and the players, even though people called him a player's coach. Well, with J.J. Redick, I don't think that wall exists as much with the players. I think they both respect him, but I also think that they can level with him on a personal level where almost, I don't want to say as a peer, but almost like a peer, that I think that relationship should lead to good transparency and overall communication from both sides, where I think J.J. Redick will also be able to speak his mind to the players without having them be too overly sensitive about it, you know?
I think you're right. I think everything you said is true. I think J.J. is a competitive MF-er. And to me, the fact that he dropped a full F-bomb in his opening press conference tells me we're about to have one fiery dude. I actually, like, I like Darvin. I thought his first year, I thought he, you know, had a lot of hurdles he had to go through. And, you know, the Russell Westbrook situation was thrown on him, right? And they made it to a conference finals. You could quibble with how much of that is him and how much of that is LeBron and AD just being incredible. But before he does it, there's still question marks. I mean, coaching a LeBron James team, as much buddy-buddy as they are, as close as they are, that's still a very tough thing to me to throw on to a first-time head coach who, again, we can talk about the championship aspirations of, like, this specific roster, but the pressure in L.A. And how that all gets to you, you really don't know until you watch it in person and until he coaches. So I think all the things you said are true. There's he brings a level of modern basketball principles to a team that I think has needed it, right? Les two coaches are Darvin Ham and Frank Vogel. Very much old school, right? Especially on the offensive end, very much in a, like, we're going to be tougher than you. We're going to bully ball. We're going to rebounding is good principles, but we're going to just, like, box out and be tough. And J.J. Redick's like, no, I'm going to run a double drag with, like, this guy coming off this screen and a cutter coming down here. Like, we are going to break down the game in a way, in a modern way. I'm excited to see it. I just, again, all these are great. I think, you know, whenever you get a new coach, all the, like, positive kind of stuff comes out. But until that first game, until you have to tell LeBron, like, hey, you know, we're going to put the ball in AD's hands here. And, you know, they're like, that, those are, like, real game situations that occur. So I'm interested to see how he handles those things. But he's a fiery, competitive MF-er that you want as a coach.
Yeah, I think the learning curve is going to be steep. And the one thing that I will always give J.J. Redick credit for is the fact that it takes a lot of work to have the long NBA career he had as just a one-dimensional shooter who couldn't play defense, right? And so, at least for me, I'm given some solace in the fact that J.J. Redick can always lean back on the fact that he was always a hard worker, right? So, but I will say I almost compartmentalize these two things, because if I zoom out far enough and put into context J.J. Redick, championship aspirations this year, I'm kind of like, yeah, that doesn't seem to fit. But unfortunately, with the Lakers' history, obviously you almost wish this is what they had done and this is what they were trying to do with Luke Walton, right? It just did not pan out. And you almost wish J.J. Redick had a Luke Walton-y sort of team, but he has LeBron James at the end of his career and Anthony Davis, right? So it sucks that it seems like the Lakers are hitting reset again during the last years of LeBron James' career. And you would have hoped that this infrastructure with J.J. Redick would have already been well established 2 years out before this. But at this point, in order to move forward, for me, I almost have to compartmentalize the two things and be like, we'll see where this takes us. For now, I'm just going to cling on to the good vibes of having like a modern day NBA coach who seems like he's going to lean on analytics and the lineup data to sort of, you know, lead the way. I think he's the type of coach who will look at the five-man lineup data and be like, oh, Max Christie and D'Angelo Russell work well together. I should play them more, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm kind of taking a better late than never approach, not putting too many lofty expectations on J.J. Redick year one, and kind of just reading what's going on in the vacuum of today. You know what I'm saying? So
I'm with you on that, and I understand trying to temper expectations. And look, I get kind of hate for this because I'm not as crazy of a hater on Darvin Ham. Like people threw the whole book at him, you know what I mean? And I understand he had his struggles, and I had questions about the rotation and some of the play calling. But you made the conference finals a year ago, lost to the defending champs. A year later, lose again to the defending champs, and you're outed. And so, like, if that's the bar of expectations, you know what I mean, of your head coach, I think that's where a tough part it is. And also, all those pretty plays, and I'm an ex in those guys for sure. I love that. None of that matters if you're like 6-10 to start the season, you know, like all those fun plays. And so it's going to be interesting to see kind of his. I'm fascinated, Jonathan, by like, because JJ's a very fiery dude, and that matches like Austin Reeves, right? Very fiery. But D'Lo's a very kind of laid back type player. So I'm very interested kind of in their kind of combination as a coach and player. And their relationship, but no, it's gonna be interesting to watch him, and hopefully this is a coach that, you know, they gave him, I believe, a long-term deal and a four-year deal, and you can grow with JJ. But you're right, it doesn't really match, right? It doesn't match. You don't put title aspirations in front of first-time head coach. Like, that's just, those are like two opposite kind of ideas that the Lakers are kind of trying to put together. But it'll be interesting to see him kind of work through and growing pains, as you said, I think is the right way to put it.
Yeah, I'm banking on just the buy-in that he hopefully gets at the start from his players. If you haven't checked out his interview with D'Lo on his podcast, I'd encourage you to do so, because it kind of gives you like a lens into, one, his relationship with D'Lo, and how they were mentioning how when D'Lo was on the Nets and they upset the Sixers that first year he went to the playoffs in game one, Redick was like, dude, you were a freaking dick to me that game. And you were telling me after you had hit a clutch shot, you were telling the coach, sit JJ Redick's ass down. He shouldn't be on the court. And he said, I hated you from that moment on, and I vowed that we would not lose another game to you guys the rest of the series. And the Sixers didn't. Like, the Sixers went 4-0 after that game one upset versus D'Lo. So it kind of gives you a lens into sort of like, I hope that's the type of relationship he can continue to have with the players where, again, they won't take offense to Redick being like, hey, you freaking suck right now. You are sitting down. This has nothing to do about the overall type of player you are. But on tonight, you're not giving the effort. So sit your ass down. You know, so I'm hoping if the X's and O's fail, if the pretty sets fail, I just hope that these guys like playing for J.J. Redick and will go to war for this, you know, coach who they respect because they remember him as a player, a competitor, as a teammate, as a dude who had him on his podcast, et cetera, et cetera. So that about does it for most of the positive stuff. I don't know. Maybe it'll still be positive. We'll see. But after the turn, let's talk a little bit about this awkward offseason, and then we'll round the corner and land the plane here by talking about what are some key things we want to see happen for next season if the Lakers are to improve, even just from an internal level? So we will catch you guys after the break.
Men, when we leave the house, it's phone, wallet, keys, how's my hair look? But if you're experiencing hair loss, you may not be so confident when you step outside your door. It's time to get that confidence back and restore your hair with Hims. No man wants to lose his hair, but for men, it's actually quite common. And now with Hims, the solution is simple. Try Hims Hair Loss Solutions and you'll be joining hundreds of thousands of subscribers who got their flow back. Men, real talk. The only thing worse than losing your hair is waiting forever for it to grow back. That's why you need Hims, and you can start seeing your hair grow back in as little as 3 to 6 months. Hims provides access to a range of hair loss treatments that work, all from the comfort of your couch. Hims makes treating hair loss simple, with doctor-trusted treatment options and clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil that can regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. They offer personalized chewable, oral, spray, and serum treatment options, so you can find what works best for you. The process is simple and 100% online. Just answer a few questions and a medical provider will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your treatment is sent directly to your door. Hims has hundreds of thousands of trusted subscribers, so if you feel like you're losing a part of yourself with your hair loss, get Hims and get your confidence back. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your personalized hair loss treatment options. hims.com/Hail Mary. Results vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil. Prescription products require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if a prescription is appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for full details and important safety information.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
All right, so we are back. Raj, let's finally talk about the offseason. Where do you stand on the Lakers' stagnant offseason? Emphasis on off, because the Lakers were off the clock. The Lakers front office was off the clock, it seems like. Have you come to terms with it? Are you pushing for at least marginal moves to be made? Or have you turned your focus on solely internal improvements that JJ and the new staff can do with this core run it back group?
So I remember when, I believe it was at the trade deadline, Chris Haynes tweeted out, the Lakers will be armed with 3 first-round picks this summer to move. Jonathan, I never bought that. I never thought that they were trading 2 first-round picks, let alone 3 first-round picks this offseason. I have a tweet, I believe on July 3rd, where I said, you know, the Lakers are going to sell us on Gabe Vincent, Jared Vanderbilt returning, and Max Christie entering the rotation. And then I think like in August, middle of August, I believe, Jovan, I believe, tweeted out that, you know, the Lakers are believing that Gabe Vincent and Jared Vanderbilt returning will, you know, improve the roster, and Max Christie, you know, getting into the rotation. So I've kind of, you know, come to terms with this being the roster. Now, the move that I'm shocked at, and I said this earlier, D'Angelo Russell opting, you know, in to his contract, like, to me, that's a move that you needed to have ready. Like, if D'Lo opts in, you know, you have a deal in place. And that's the one I'm pretty surprised at. Everything else kind of falls in line. I never believed the 2 first-round picks were on the table. I never believed Austin Reeves was on the table. And even the deals, Jonathan, I don't know about you, I'm not on the trade machine. I don't use that. You know, I don't open up the trade machine and sit on there. I feel like that's very crazy behavior to sit on there and do that. The people who do that for hours, respect to you, but I never thought Austin Reeves was really available. I mean, maybe for like a Donovan Mitchell, who again is just very much just a pipe dream to me, at least in my opinion. I just never thought those kind of deals were legit on the table this summer. Gabe Vincent did not really, he played, but I don't really count that. I like, that was a very much 50% maybe of Gabe Vincent that we watched, Jared Vanderbilt as well. These are all your tradable contracts, right? Rui Hachimura I thought he had an okay year during the regular season and really struggled during the postseason. And obviously, to me, your salary to move was D'Lo. And if you don't move him, and you don't, I guess, and the Lakers thinking is not to attach a first round pick to him, then you're going to have a very similar roster. But if you sold me this, Jonathan, like 3 or 4 weeks ago, or maybe before the offseason, if the sell was, hey, game one, we had a huge lead against Denver. Game two, Jamal Murray hits a game winner. Like, if you want to sell me on that, you can. But that's not what was sold. The sell was we're going to move first round picks. We're going to go and get some improvement on the roster. And so I've kind of come to terms with it. I understand it. The Lakers, to me, are not in Tyler Buss mode. And I know that's insane to say for a 40-year-old LeBron James. But you just look at the moves, and it's kind of similar to me to like what the Warriors are doing, where they're not really offering. Jonathan Kuminga's not really on the table. Maybe for Lauri Markkanen, you never really know. The Lakers, I don't believe, really had their first-round picks on the table, and they believe LeBron's not going anywhere. I don't believe LeBron is going anywhere. His son is now on the roster, which is, again, just an absurd thing to say out loud. But LeBron James' son is rostered here for 4 years. So I think like they're kind of in this middle ground, and the tough part is the West is absolute hell. Like, the West is just an absurd hellfire to sit in, and you have a new coach and all that. But I'm kind of at peace. I like the push for younger development. They just hired the developmental coach as well. I believe his name is Ty Abbott. Was a new developmental coach that they just hired, and that's all great and good. Those things don't match with a title or bust kind of mentality. But I think it's the right decision. The Lakers have been long overdue for like going into younger and development and developing young players and getting, you know, great value out of the first round picks. They've been drafting projects the last few years and they look like projects. So that's kind of where I'm at with this. I've kind of come to peace with it. I still believe if you have LeBron and AD, I think the Olympics kind of change perception in a way. Like, one of my takes, Jonathan, is that like the Lakers cannot have Olympic AD. That's not possible. You can't have a guy making max salary like not have an offensive role. Like, it's just not really. Minnesota has it with Gobert a little bit, but So I think the Olympics kind of changed perception. But I still believe you put LeBron and AD in a playoff series, maybe against anyone other than Denver, and like you really have a really good shot. Well, maybe Denver now that they have Russell Westbrook. Who knows? I still believe that LeBron and AD in the right situation, and even this roster maybe can like really win you a few rounds. But I don't believe this team is title or bust, and that's kind of my expectations going into next year.
But maybe LeBron, AD, and Steph Curry make some noise. We can get to that in a second. But I agree with you that when D'Angelo Russell opted in, I was like, oh, they probably have the next domino falling any minute now. Right. But they didn't. And as I have sat with this over the summer, I think I've realized multiple things, not only from the front office end, but also just the CBA landscape and what teams are doing. I think if it were up to the Lakers and they had a deal and there was a deal out there that, one, not only upgraded D'Angelo Russell's position, but also one where if they had to attach a first round pick, they were also getting something in return that made sense, they would have done it. But I think the problem with D'Angelo Russell, this team in particular, is the fact that D'Angelo Russell isn't Russell Westbrook, and it's not like we can just offload. One, he's not making $47 million, so you're not getting three players in return. You're probably getting one, and you have to tack on more stuff onto D'Angelo Russell's contract. But yeah, D'Angelo Russell, at least as far as the regular season is concerned, obviously provides this team value, and that's almost understating it because in the regular season, he's arguably your third best player on some nights. So the thing that I realized was maybe, I don't know if this is right or not, but I think the Lakers realized that D'Angelo Russell has more value to them than any other team out there. And the other thing that's kind of not as crazy if you really peel back the layers here, because you said at the top that it seems crazy that D'Angelo Russell is still on this team. But when I take a step back and realize that J.J. Redick is our head coach, like the J.J. Redick, who's one of the most prolific three-point shooters in NBA history, and think about the system that he wants to run in terms of a motion offense, a five-out offense with lots of cutting and off-ball movement and flare screens for shooters. I'm like, the one guy who did that most consistently last season was D'Angelo Russell. So to me, there is some sort of value, even if, let's say, the Lakers were hell-bent on trading D'Angelo Russell. I still think there may be some sort of value in, well, let's see what J.J. Redick does with D'Angelo Russell first. And if we do still need to trade him, I'm almost in the line of thinking that the Lakers should be trading D'Angelo Russell for a similar sort of player anyways, someone who can shoot threes and playmake. That player just needs to be better and more consistent in the playoffs, you know? So for me, D'Angelo Russell is the stand-in for the player the Lakers will eventually trade for, or he's just on the team again and the Lakers make some marginal trades that actually bolster our defense elsewhere. You know what I mean? So that's one line of thinking. The other line of thinking that helped me come to terms with a lot of this stuff is the fact that it seems like the whole NBA is sort of just trying to figure out apron world in general, because most teams seem hesitant to do anything drastic. And if you look at the players that Lakers fans have talked about in terms of trade targets, Jeremy Grant, Bruce Brown, Dorian Finney-Smith, Cam Johnson, you name it, all these names, the Lakers haven't traded for any of them, obviously, right? But neither have any other team in the rest of the NBA. So that almost tells me something. Like, what is that telling me? It's telling me that these teams probably have very unrealistic asking prices for these sorts of players. And the one thing that I do sort of want to continue to highlight is, I agree with you, the Lakers are not going to be trading 3 first-round picks. I don't think they're going to be trading 2 first-round picks. But I also don't, so this is, I don't know if this is controversial or not, but I also don't think they should be trading 2 first-round picks, because the 2 first-round picks that they now have at their disposal to trade, the 2029 first and the 2030 first, this is like, I think people need to wrap their heads around just, I don't want people to misconstrue this and say, like, I'm not saying, like, don't go all in for LeBron. I'm just saying, I think we just have to get a better valuation on these picks, because these are not the same picks the Dallas Mavericks traded at the trade deadline last season for Daniel Gafford and PJ Washington. Okay, they like traded a pick swap in order to get a late 2024 first from OKC to get Daniel Gafford. Okay, we're talking about a LeBron-less and AD-less first round picks in the future that I would almost sort of parallel to when the Brooklyn Nets traded their first to the Boston Celtics for Paul Pierce, Kevin Durant, et cetera, et cetera. You know, like, what ended up happening to the Nets in that scenario? The Celtics ended up drafting Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum. That's the type of catastrophic thing that could happen if the Lakers trade 2029 and 2030 first and don't get the proper package back, if that makes any sense. Sure. Now, I'm not saying that should stunt them from making a move that helps LeBron James win a championship now. What I am saying is, they just need to continue to be very shrewd about what they get in return, because the trade packages that I'm seeing from fans do not exemplify that shrewdness that I'm looking for, you know, because D'Lo and a 2029 first for Dorian Finney-Smith and Cam Johnson, I'm not even sure. I don't know, you know, did we make the proper assessment to make sure that this is going to at least help us continue to contend? And I don't want to get into discussions of, like, does this move the needle or not? I think
Right.
all those discussions fall on a spectrum. I'm just saying the Lakers are smart to continue to be smart within reason. And for me, I guess the question I want to ask you now is, like, if you were to trade the 2029 first, what type of value are you looking for in return, understanding the fact that we will also have to trade salary ballast that's actual on-court production as well along with it? Because for me, I've kind of landed in this place where if they trade the 2029 first, let's say it's like fully unprotected, I think the Lakers need to get an upgraded version of what they got in the 2023 trade deadline when they traded that top 4 2027 first to Utah along with Russell Westbrook's contract to get D'Lo, Vando, and Beasley. And I say upgraded because if the Lakers trade the 2029 first, they need to kill 2 or 3 birds with one stone. It can't just be a Bruce Brown and, like, whatever, you know? It's like, no, it needs to be, we need to get 3 different positions of need, and those need to be players that we could potentially sign long-term. And I say upgraded because D'Lo, Vando, and Beasley, you know, they have served us fine, but we need something better than that because it's a 2029 first and likely when LeBron James has already retired. So where do you stand on the value of those firsts?
So I'm so glad you brought up Dallas, Jonathan, because this was my, so I want to be clear. I've mentioned the Lakers aren't in win now mode. I am not upset about not trading all these first round picks. Like, I think Rob Pelinka gets a lot of crap, which, I mean, I totally understood, but I think one of his jobs is to be level headed about this, right? Mm-hmm. His job is to make sure the Lakers don't, you know, to throw away all their assets to go and get
two firsts for Jeremy Grant.
Right. And I am nowhere near the Jeremy Grant camp. Keep a player that's been in a losing situation kind of far away from me. But like my dream offseason, I guess, Jonathan, was I think you needed to close on Klay Thompson. I don't know where you were on Klay Thompson, mm-hmm. but I thought like LeBron mentioned he would take a pay cut. I don't know how much of that was, you know, legitimate or whatever it was. But I thought you needed to close on Klay. I thought he was the best player you can get really for free if LeBron was really able to kind of, you know, take less money. And then you can kind of, you fill in Klay in that D'Lo spot, and then you move D'Lo for hopefully a big or, you know, a Wendell Carter Jr. or whatever. That was kind of my, you know, dream offseason. But I think in this NBA landscape, like one first round pick really isn't getting you much. Like it's just not. Lauri Markkanen, like Utah was asking for 5 first round picks. Mikal Bridges just went for, I believe it was 5 first round picks and players within that deal, right? It's just, OG Anunoby during the, you know, trade deadline went for RJ Barrett and Emmanuel Quickly. Emmanuel Quickly now is a $30 million player. RJ Barrett, I believe, was on like a $25 million deal. Like it's just, one first round pick plus D'Lo, and I'm seeing the trade package. Like, honestly, I talked to people in Portland, like, that doesn't get you Jeremy Grant. Like, it just D'Lo plus dead salary and like one first does not get you Jeremy Grant. All of these teams are asking for Austin Reeves, which, like, again, you look at the Lakers roster, you go down it, it's like LeBron, you're not trading LeBron, you're not trading AD. After that, it's Austin Reeves. Like, that's the player they asked for. And I think the Lakers rightfully look at Austin as a win. They look at his contract, right? I don't think, Austin, you could just look at his production. You have to look at the contract. It's what, $12 million deal. If you are not putting Austin on the table, Jonathan, I just don't think there's very many deals to be made. It's just like, mm-hmm. and plus you combine that with they aren't moving 2 first round picks, because I think I'm with you. I think that's a smart, level-headed decision. And honestly, there aren't, like, are you getting Donovan Mitchell for 2 first round? Like, even if he was on the table, probably not. Like, I don't think Cleveland is giving you down. So, like, you go down the list of players that are available. And it's why I think the Lakers decided to stay pat. And again, the one move I would like was to have some D'Lo upgrade. And the problem with D'Lo to me, I think all those things you said are true. D'Lo is 100% necessary in our 82-game grind of a regular season. I think LeBron being almost being 40 has to be contextualized in this. This is not 32-year-old LeBron. Needs the ball handling help. D'Lo broke the Lakers record in three-point shooting. Not just that, he's the only volume three-point shooter on the team.
Yep.
Other than Dalton Connect, who I'm high on, but I mean, that's a lot to put volume onto Dalton Connect's expectation. D'Lo shot 8 threes a game. I think Austin gets up like 5, and those are, you know, on open threes. D'Lo can shoot off the bounce and really can put them up in a way that we lose the math game a lot of the times when D'Lo doesn't play, which is why I think we are so, like, our record is so bad when he doesn't play, is because we lose the math game a ton. LeBron, you know, LeBron's 3-point, you know, shot was good last year, but he still doesn't take them at that level. So yeah, I think D'Lo's playoffs versus his regular season production is so vast. And I'm not just talking about his shooting percentage. It's just, when you take the shooting away, which the playoffs usually does, right? Like, shooting's already, you know, a tough thing to kind of be consistent at. You take that away, and all of a sudden, D'Lo doesn't rebound, doesn't defend well, like, and like he gets mentally checked out. Like, that's a thing that I think needed to be upgraded this summer. And the fact they didn't, I think, makes it tougher to do at the deadline. But I'm with you. Like, I don't think there was a move out there really that warranted putting 2+ or even 2+ Dalton in it plus Austin. I don't think that move existed, which I think why you're in this position. But I'm seeing stuff like Josh, like the Thunder getting Caruso for Josh Giddey, you know, like just like little deals like that, which pissed me off for a very long time, by the way. That deal is absolutely absurd, and I don't know what's going on in Chicago. But you know, I think there were kind of marginal moves to make there, which they decided not to, and they're hoping on development from my guy JHS. I don't think he's ready to play next year, but we can speak on him at the end. They're hoping development for Max Christie. Again, they're hoping for Gabe Vincent to find his health. Jared Vanderbilt obviously was a huge key component of the roster from a year ago. Didn't play really last season either, so they're hoping from that. But yeah, I'm with you on the first round picks. I think most teams aren't really just moving them willy-nilly anymore, unless it's for a star. And the Lakers look like they're gonna stay pat and hopefully, you know, make a run this year with another healthy season from LeBron and AD.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, this isn't really a hot take, but one of my biggest predictions is that I think the Lakers are actually set up to make one of their best LeBron James and AD era trades ever that since they have had these two. And I say that because I look at their collection of assets, and just because they haven't made a trade yet and because they've been dormant the last two periods, that does not mean they're not going to make a trade. And in fact, I point to the 2023 trade deadline as sort of like a mini precursor of what could be to come. The reason why we didn't make a trade in last season's off, people are like, the Lakers haven't made an offseason, haven't made offseason deals in 2 years. I'm like, the reason why they didn't make any deals last offseason was because everybody was like, continuity, please keep the same core. They did the same core. They re-signed guys. You know, that was actually something new for the Lakers. That's why they didn't make any trades. This season, the reason why they're not making trades is because, again, during the summer, teams are happy with where they're at, and they have license to put out unrealistic asking prices for players. You mentioned a 2029 first isn't getting you Jeremy Grant, and I would say, yes, it is, especially by this trade deadline. The pushback, though, is the Lakers should not be giving their 2029 first for Jeremy Grant. It's the Portland Trailblazers insane front office that thinks that they can get more than a 2029 first for Jeremy Grant, when they should actually be ecstatic if the Lakers are even offering them that pick, which is happening again in a non-LeBron James era Lakers. You know, that's insane to even trade. And I think Jeremy Grant will have just gotten off that contract by 2029, you know, something crazy like that. But yeah, back to my point, if it's any solace to you, I do think the Lakers are perfectly set up by mid-December when they can trade, you know, also by mid-December, by the way, that's when you can re-aggregate all of the veteran minimum contracts that you've compiled. Mm-hmm. I know in the summer you can only add one or whatever, but from December 15th all the way to the trade deadline, Jaxson Hayes, Cam Reddish, Christian Wood, you can compile them all together to make, I think that's like $9 million expiring. And then you've got D'Lo's expiring. Even the guys who aren't necessarily like expiring in Rui Hachimura, Jared Vanderbilt, and Gabe Vincent, those are still actually useful players, though, that other teams can flip or actually use. And then on top of it, you've got guys like Dalton Connect and Max Christie as well, if they continue to pan out. And I'm not saying you should trade these guys or just look at them solely as trade assets, but when I look at the collection of assets that the Lakers have finally compiled, yes, it sucks that you don't have like a unnecessary salary ballast, like a Malik Beasley floating around, where if you traded him, you won't miss him. But at the same time, the other side of that coin is, well, you actually have kind of useful NBA players on decent contracts. So I think when the time is right and the Lakers are able to find that, I'm not going to use the word perfect, but a deal that makes sense for those first, I think they're going to be able to do it. So you guys can hold me to that, but I truly believe that the Lakers are set up to make their best AD and LeBron era trade since these two have been here. Because what was the last best one? It was probably the D'Lo, Vando, Beasley, and then they got Rui Hachimura for 3 seconds, right? If you look to that trade deadline as sort of like a Kroger brand's version of what they could do this season, then I think you might, I'm selling a lot of copium right now, I understand that. But if you look to that season, that was also the last trade deadline where we had multiple expirings. And at the trade deadline last season, the only expiring was Torian Prince at $4.5 million. And you already know Darvin Ham was not going to relinquish his favorite player. So now that we have multiple expirings, as well as young players on decent contracts like Dalton Connect or Max Christie, if that's what it requires, I think the Lakers can do something. It's just a matter of if those deals are available and whether they're willing to take that jump, you know? So.
Sure. I'll sell some more copium in a second, but I think my issue with that is I think that's hugely dependent on what the Lakers are at that point, right? I think there's a level of if they're too far behind, there's not really a reason to make a move. And just, you know, bouncing back on your point, I really like the Beasley move, and Beasley didn't pan out But I thought his contract was something we needed to keep. We obviously let him go to, I believe, sign Taurean Prince. We got the exemption. And I believe that we were supposed to get Bruce Brown, but then Indiana, for some reason, threw $20 million a year at Bruce Brown. But I believe those contracts would have been extremely useful. But instead, we let Beasley walk for a minimum. We also let Mo Bamba walk as well, right? We did not extend both of those. And those are contracts that are useful. So I wish we would have kept those and kind of were able to have those as assets. But Jonathan, something I've been living and dying on in is that I thought that Denver series was a lot closer than people remember. And I'm one of the psychos that went and rewatched all those games. Like, those games were extremely close. KCP just came out a couple weeks ago. I don't know if you saw it, but I believe he's on Draymond's pod and said the Lakers should have beat us. And I can't tell you how much that hurt to watch and to like watch him kind of admit that. And not just KCP admitting that to me is saying like their whole team was kind of in that vibe of, hey, we're getting our ass beat against, you know, against this Laker team. And yet, you know, Jamal Murray hits the game winner game two. Aaron Gordon has like a 35-15 game in game three. And that's all she wrote, where you're down 3-0. But it's just, it's tough. And I have empathy for fans who don't want to see the same roster again that just got 4-1 out of the playoffs, right? And I think it's tough to kind of, I think that's where like the separation is between front office and like the messaging of, hey, we got Dalton Connect, Bronny James, and here's a healthy Gabe Vincent, and here's a healthy Jared Vanderbilt, and here's first time ever head coach JJ Redick, and it's going to be different this time. You know, so like I understand where I guess the frustrations are. But I'm with you. I think the right move was not to move all three first round picks. There was no trade available for that. We can get into the Steph stuff if you want. But yeah, I think the Lakers are they're kind of in the middle pack with, like, to me, with Phoenix and, you know, Memphis and just this hodgepodge of teams who all believe, like, in the right situation, they can win a playoff series. And I think that's really what the West is. And you'll see people separate themselves from the pack, but it's going to be a fun battle in the Western Conference.
Yeah. And if you want a little bit more copium, you know, I also agree that, you know, those types of deals that happen at the trade deadline are contingent upon the team actually showing some sort of competitive edge or the fact that they're still in the standings. I think the play-in helps with that, because if you look back at the 2022-23 season, what, they started 2-10. And I think when they made the first deal for Rui Hachimura, we were like 19-22. So you could have said back then, it doesn't make any sense to make any trades. But you know what's crazy about that deadline? People like to talk about, you know, Kendrick Nunn and 3 seconds for Rui Hachimura and Russell Westbrook and the first for D'Lo, Vando, and Beasley, and even Pat Bev and a second for Mo Bamba. One of the best trades during that deadline was Thomas Bryant's expiring for 3 seconds and Davon Reed. Nobody talks about that, but I'm just using this as an example of when you have expiring contracts, even if it's at a veteran minimum deal, and that player can somewhat produce on the court, when the time is right, you can have a Thomas Bryant for 3 seconds sort of deal, which I think the Lakers used to then ship one of them off to, like, Orlando for the Bamba deal or whatever. I'm just saying the Lakers have way more options. Yes, they would have had way more options if they have kept Beasley and Bamba last season. And I think if they had, we would have had a trade deadline deal to upgrade the roster, but we didn't. But I think they've learned from that clearly. And so now I think heading into this trade deadline, they will be better armed.
Make no mistake, Trump-backed Bernie Moreno is a MAGA mistake for black families in Ohio.
We're not going to replace racism in this country from decades ago with a new form of racism, which is what DEI is.
If Bernie Moreno is elected senator, he will support the MAGA playbook and implement the thinly disguised Racist Project 2025 agenda. That means ending diversity, equity, and inclusion programs that exist to correct the impacts of racism. MAGA extremists like Moreno believe programs that have helped our families are entitlement programs, but they have no problem giving their buddies a boost by passing more tax giveaways for rich folks like themselves. Black Americans like me have worked hard and persevered in fighting for a fair shot. We've come too far to let self-serving extremists like Bernie Moreno take us back. That's why we must re-elect Senator Sherrod Brown. He has fought for equal opportunity for black families and will continue to do so. Go to OhioVoterGuide.org and register by October 7th. Paid for by WinSenate, which is responsible for the content of this ad. WinSenate.org, not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now, I want to turn the attention to what they have been selling us with regards to a healthy Gabe Vincent, a healthy Vando, and just talk about specifically Jared Vanderbilt. And I'm going to have a video coming out, I think it may be tomorrow, just on Jared Vanderbilt's last 10-game stretch of the season, because that's when I feel like he looked the healthiest, but also that's the stretch in which, before his unfortunate midfoot injury versus the Celtics, where it seemed like he also had a better understanding and grasp of where he fit into the five-out offense and just being a better off-ball movement cutter. And so where do you stand on the Rui versus Vando debate? Because time is a flat circle and we are back here again. And who do you think should start at the three next season for the Lakers? Should it be Rui Hachimura, Jared Vanderbilt, or insert other player?
Really quickly before that, you mentioned Thomas Bryant. I just think it's absolutely hilarious. Thomas Bryant requested a trade to come out of the Lakers for more minutes and went to a team that has a center that's more healthier than the guy that he's playing behind here.
Yeah.
Number two, he loses his minutes rotation to DeAndre Jordan. I think that's just a hilarious kind of result to Thomas Bryant's.
How did we get 3 seconds for that? I don't know. It's still amazing, but it's, you know, it's possible.
Well, after first round picks got so valuable, second rounders got devalued during that deadline. So I think that's how we came out with. But John, I've stuck my flag on Vando Island. Like, I've been there since last season. I was very much on the Vando need start. And a lot of that to me is because LeBron during the regular season, rightfully, and even at that age when he was turning 39, the motor just isn't what it is. And I think you need just a high motor guy in the lineup. And that's not really what Rui does. And Rui got better as a cutter. It's just you need someone who's just constant motion and motor at all times. Even AD, as great as he is, I think he just needs another energy bouncing ball next to him that can help and rebound. And I always say this about Vando. It's very impressive to me. One of my favorite type of players, a guy who, and I'm not saying he can't do these things, I'm just comparing this from an NBA level of skill, can't really dribble, right? Can't shoot, can't handle, you can't really throw him the ball, you know, in traffic. And yet he's making $12, $13 million a year because he's absolutely special at the other stuff he does. He's one of the best offensive rebounders to me in the game. I think he has one of the best hands in terms of instincts defensively. He's a guy that's very versatile on the defensive end. You can throw him on a Luka Doncic at the top of the key, or you can have him guard forwards at the bottom and he can tip passes away. I think he needs to start. I think Rui needs kind of his own space. I think Rui needs like an airspace to kind of operate. I just don't think the best use of $17 million Rui is have him sit in the corner. I think that works sometimes. He gets cuts off of that. It's just waiting for the ball really gets him out of any fluidity, any motion. Mm-hmm. So I'd love him off the bench. I think you can stick him with D'Lo in a second unit or Austin in a second unit. But Vando, I think, really thrives around other really awesome offensive players, right? Going in screening for D'Lo, screening for Austin. Again, just constant action. JJ will obviously have a lot of sets, but Vando's a guy that creates sets. Like, you know, when there's a lot of stagnant motion, Vando will just go set a pin screen where like a guy sitting in the corner, he just screens for him and the guy will get an open three. Just little stuff like that. Like that stuff that like Rui doesn't do, because that's just not the type of player he is, right? Rui's like, no, I'm waiting for the ball. Why would I go screen for this guy when I'm like absolutely waiting for the ball? Not in any selfish way. It's just kind of the mentality there is of a scorer, while Vando's like, oh, this guy, the shot's going up, I'm going to sprint hard as hell from the corner and someone has to box me out. And now like you add that type of energy and motor and rebounding prowess with an AD who's already a monster on the board. It's just, I like their combinations. And I think like if you have Vando in less offensive kind of units, I think his versatility lessens and his value lessens to me. So I'd like him to start. I think that was the plan. People would forget this, but first preseason game, Vando did start. He actually hit two threes, which I'll always
seven mention. Rebounds. Yep.
Yeah. Looked super healthy, and obviously the injury happened in that game, and I just was never himself. You talked about the last 10 games. I thought even in the playing game, Jonathan, like there or not, yeah, not in the playing game, excuse me, the in-season tournament, I thought you saw some of the stuff return, right? Vando energy and just action, and I thought that was when he also looked a little healthy, and he had just these bumps and bruises all season that kept him out. But I'm on the star Vando train. I just think like you have, if D'Lo and Austin obviously are still going to be your starters, and I would just like to kind of pair that with as much kind of defensive versatility as you can, and as many guys that can give LeBron a break on that end.
Yeah, I can be convinced either way. I'm not sure if I have a strong opinion on who should definitely start at the three between Vando and Rui, just because I think there is an argument to be made that, you know, I mean, not to downplay what Rui did last season, but the team went 22-10 after he started, and then he averaged, what, 16 points on 57% from the field and 44% from three to close the year. I mean, it's just those are kind of insane efficiency numbers for a guy who was, what, the fifth player, the fifth option on that starting lineup. And the one thing I'll give Rui credit for is even during that stretch of his, like, his defensive intensity improves a whole lot better when he's able to score that efficiently, you know? But right. But I think that's an argument for Vando, right? Where Rui feeds off of his offense to also be a pretty good defensive player, whereas Vando, you know, even if his offense never comes around, he's always feeding off of his defense regardless. That's the only thing that's going to get his game up. My only pushback to a potential Vando starting would be, it's all going to boil down to his health and whether he's legitimately sure. healthy to start the season, because if we're in a situation again where it takes him like a month to like ramp up, and I think just because of how much Vando exerts himself and how much we need him to cover ground on the floor, and he's had a history of foot injuries like dating back from when he was in college, mm-hmm. I almost view Vando as like maybe he is a player that's just going to have to be capped at 22 to 25 minutes per game. So if that's the case, maybe Rui starting actually helps preserve Vando in the long run. I could see it going both ways, but I would also like to go back to the continuity of that 2022-23 season when Vando was starting, the Lakers closed the season out 18-8. And then, you know, they went to the Western Conference Finals, even though I know Vando got played out of some of those series. Like, he just does a better job of sort of balancing the starting units with all of the offensive players there. I just hope that if they start off with Vando, they know for sure he's ready to go and hit the ground running, because from a durability standpoint, Rui probably doesn't give you the defensive ceiling, but he probably gives you like the best of even worlds on all ends of the spectrum with regards to, so you got the offense, but you've also got some defense if his offense is clicking, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe you just want to, you know, play it safe to start off and then maybe think about starting Vando later, but I don't know.
Yeah, I could, you know, I wouldn't be mad if Rui started. I think the whole world, the whole Laker world was pushing for him to start, especially, you know, over Taurean Prince. And you know, when it finally happened, the Lakers went on a run. I almost separate the Lakers playoffs kind of lineups and rotations from the regular season, right? And I think the Lakers are in a very unique position because their star, still best player, I believe, is turning 40. Like, I think those are all context that needs to be put in what I think helps LeBron get through a regular season grind, right? Is a D'Angelo Russell, an offensive guy who maybe, you know, in the playoffs, you don't want running your offense because that's just not going to be efficient enough for playoff defense. I mean, obviously, and Vanderbilt, who in a playoff setting, it's much easier to kind of game plan and, you know, other teams stick their center on Vando a lot and really mucks your offense up. But I think in a regular season context where, you know, you're playing games every other night, it's just important to have like motion and movement and guys with super high motor really excel in those environments. But I can see Rui as well. I think Rui did improve. I think he needs to become better at, you know, a little bit better of a rebounder. Like, I'd like him again. I think he has more defensive kind of skills than he gives himself credit for. He'll never have the foot speed to kind of stay with guys. But I think like just down low as a defensive force, like there's a level of like force and power that Rui can exert that I feel like he just doesn't, unless he's like offensively engaged in the game, which again, when you're playing next to two other guys who average 25 a game, Like, it's very tough for you. And it's credit to him that he was able to get to a 16. He also shot very well. Again, became a really good baseline cutter, understanding timing and all that stuff. He had a very good connection with D'Lo on those passes. But again, in a playoff setting, that's a lot less. You don't get those back cuts. Like, teams are scouting all that stuff. So yeah, it's an interesting kind of conundrum the Lakers are in, where they're probably going to need to experiment with a lot of stuff. And JJ has a lot on his plate, but yeah, I would just lean on the defense, since our guards already are so are not really defensive stalwarts that we're starting. I would like to have a couple more defensive minded players to start the game. But I could see Rui. I wouldn't be pissed at it. I would understand. Rui's a $17 million guy. Probably thought he was starting anyway. And so I could see it both ways.
Yeah, if Vando's healthy and he looks like how he looked those last 10 games, then for sure, start him with that group that got us to the Western Conference Finals. So I've had you longer than I had anticipated. For the last 5 minutes here, let's just talk about, like, what's a key for you heading into next season that you're looking towards if the Lakers are to actually improve internally first, but even before thinking about any trades. And I'll just give my spiel real quick before you go. So for me, my player key to LA exceeding expectations next season would be Max Christie, because for me, if Max Christie pans out and he can consistently assume that surefire 3-and-D role for the Lakers, I feel like it opens up so many more possibilities for the team and organization as a whole. It opens up the possibility of Max starting next to Austin Reeves. It opens up the possibility of Max starting next to D'Lo. It opens up the possibility of Max starting next to AR and D'Lo. We didn't talk about Max potentially starting at the three. I don't know if that's an option, but if one day Max is strong enough to hold up against small forwards, I don't know. I could see a lineup where JJ throws them all three of them out there, you know, and it might actually work. It also opens up the possibility of Max Christie maybe making Gabe Vincent sort of redundant to the point where the Lakers can more easily trade Gabe Vincent out without worrying about losing his, you know, point of attack defense production on the court. And then lastly, if Max Christie pans out through the first half of the season, it also opens up the possibility of the Lakers being able to assemble a better overall trade package for someone substantial by using Max Christie's nice $8 million per year contract as a sweetener piece. Again, I don't want to say that we should trade Max Christie, but that's just one of the side benefits of, hey, if Max Christie is panning out, then all of a sudden teams are like, okay, we'll actually engage with you because we're kind of interested in Max because he's only getting paid $8 million the next 3 years, you know? So that's my sort of key player to look at for the Lakers, even though he was also my key player to look at last season. But what about you?
First of all, I would be so sad if Max Christie is finally good and finally gets rotations and we trade him. Like, that would make me so disappointed. I would feel like I've won, but at what cost? I have a few things. Number one, I think people forget last year, Austin Reeves was coming off the Olympics, right? And then had a terrible start to the season. It was why he was benched for Cam Reddish, which was still, I believe, the wrong move. But in any case, it did jump start the team. The team did start winning. But if Austin has any leap next, like one more, I guess, just offensive leap, maybe more of an off the bounce 3-point shooter. And I think Austin does work. I think he has a really good work ethic. And I think there could be like one little more, not a huge jump, but I think just one more jump as an offensive creator, especially as a passer, especially in pick and roll situations. And you can kind of help LeBron in that manner. And I think if Dalton Connect hits, like I was, you know, watching Miami basically get to start Jaime Jaquez, like I that's a huge boost to your rotation. It just, like, it's a level of jump that the salary cap gives you when you hit on a first round pick like that. And Jaime Jaquez did that for the Heat. Brandon Pajemski for the Warriors, all guys drafted near my guy, Jalen Huchefino, of course, who was not able to play. And, you know, maybe we can speak about him a little bit at the end. But those are my two things. Like, if Austin can take a little bit more of a jump, and, you know, doesn't come into the season with shot legs, you could tell, like, he was absolutely exhausted from that Olympic tenure. And then if Dalton Connect really can hit, that just, if you can get a player in your rotation, Jonathan, that's making the money he is, it just boosts everything else. You talked about what it does, especially for the Gabe Vincent contract as well. That makes that more. I'm already off the Gabe Vincent ship. Sure. First of all, players coming from Miami, that we've already had that experience for a while. And we already have so many guards. Like, I understand his point of attack defense is important. I think he's a very streaky shooter. I like the addition when we got him. I'm concerned that he's kind of going to take another year before he gets back to himself. But those are my two jumps. I think those are possible. I think they're in the realm of like possibility. I'm not sure how many more wins that adds. The Lakers won, what, at least 48 games last year, which is still a pretty high number. You have to contextualize that with LeBron and AD both playing over like 75 games, which I'm a little worried what the Olympics will do to that. to that number. But yeah, I think if those two can make the necessary jumps, then you have a team that can probably get over the 50 win mark.
Yeah, I think a refreshed Austin Reeves from the get-go should hopefully be a huge difference, because he was a vastly more confident and different playmaker second half of the season. I think he was like 6 assists, and then he dropped his turnover rate, et cetera, where started the season, it seemed like he was running on fumes and sort of just bobbling the ball here and there into defenders. And that kind of sort of, that all kind of got sorted out and ironed out by the midseason, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that'll be a huge difference. And then if Dalton Connect can give us that oomph off the bench, just being that perfect sort of offensive connector piece off ball and helping JJ Redick's offense hum, I think that will be a huge difference maker. Although he kind of falls into that same line of thinking with regards to, if Max Christie pans out and Dalton Connect pans out, yeah, guess which players teams are going to be asking from the Lakers, you know? So it's going to be an interesting sort of dance that they're going to have to walk by the trade deadline. But yeah, so the last question I want to ask you, let's really, really quickly, let's say 2 minutes, talk about Steph Curry and LeBron James, because they have been on this ever since the Olympics, this LeBron and Curry love fest tour. Have you allowed yourself to actually entertain a scenario where Steph Curry is a Laker? And before you answer that question, I am one of those insane people who go on the trade machine and see what what things work out. And here is the structure, Raj. Here's okay, what it's going to take, and here's what it's going to look like. D'Angelo Russell's $18.7 million contract. Austin Reeves, $12.9 million contract. Rui Hachimura at $17 million. Gabe Vincent at $11 million. So that's $59.6 million going out. D'Lo, AR, okay, Rui, and Gabe. That will do it. $59.6 million going out. Plus, obviously, the two first, 2029 and 2031. Right. Add some pick swaps, whatever you need to do to get the deal done. Okay. In return, the Lakers would get Steph Curry, $55.7 million. Lindy Waters at $2.1 million and Gui Santos at $1.8 million. That is $59.6 million incoming as well, because I believe both teams are like above first apron teams and they need to make it match. So that is what it would take. The Lakers would be able to keep Jared Vanderbilt, Max Christie, JHS, and Dalton Connect. What are your thoughts on an AD, LeBron, Vando, Max Christie, and Steph Curry starting unit with Connect, JHS, Jackson Hayes, Christian Wood, and not much else off the bench? Is that moving you?
So first of all, you send that trade in before Mike Dunleavy Jr. like sobers up. Like, you make sure that trade gets accepted and thrown in. First of all, I would 100% do that deal. You're getting another top 10 player, maybe top 5 player, whatever you think Steph Curry is. I never let myself really, believe that he was ever. I think both LeBron and Steph are very comfortable where they're at. Steph, obviously, 4 championships with his incumbent team. And usually players who won that many titles aren't going to just destroy worlds to get out of there. And Steph, to me, doesn't really come off as that kind of, right? Like, I would understand if his only ring was the one he won in 2014, then he can like really shake things up. But I just don't believe that's coming. And LeBron looks very settled in Los Angeles. So it was fun watching them in the Olympics. It was fun watching them and KD have this kind of final run. Although I think KD mm-hmm. might, suit up in Los Angeles. It's funny because watching the Olympics, I totally forgot that like Kevin Durant and Devin Booker are teammates. Like, that totally yeah. just was lost on me. LeBron and AD was mentioned almost every single time, but like, I was like, oh yeah, Devin Booker's also the teammate of KD. But those three kind of had their moment, and it was cool to watch them close it out and win gold. And watching LeBron, like, it's really unfair to the rest of the world. Like, Steph was setting a screen for LeBron, and like, you had to defend that somehow, and Steph is just getting wide open threes because of it, and the rest of the world's like, this is just unfair. Although like, Serbia gave them a really tough game in the gold medal game, but no, it was cool to watch them just legends, generational players do it at the biggest stage. And obviously Steph having his first Olympics, which is insane to think about for the career that he's had, but injuries have kind of, you know, derailed his Olympic career. But it's cool. I tweeted it out, like, Steph was way too great to not have a moment like this. And he did. So no, I never believed it. I think both of them are going to go back to they're in weirdly similar situations to me. Like, we don't have a Kuminga, we have like our first round picks, but both of them are kind of in this middle, like, yeah, we're developing.
We do have a Kuminga. It's our Kuminga is Austin Reeves.
Yes, kind of. Yes, right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, Austin's not going to sign a $200 million contract next season. So we'll,
that's true.
So at least, you know, we're in a little bit better boat there. But yeah, to me, they're in like very similar spots and kind of just looking over, you know, at each other in like, you know, yeah, I wish I was there, but I got to be over here. And, you know, Steph's looking at LeBron like, yeah, I wish I was over there, but I'm over here kind of thing. So yeah, I never got myself to buy it, but it was fun to watch for a summer.
I'm in the exact same boat as you. I think both of them are just lapping up the experience together, and what a unique experience for them to do so at what, age 36 and age 39, whatever their ages are. And the fact that, yeah, this is a once in a lifetime thing for them at the end of their careers. And I think they are just soaking it all in. And I think that is what that Love Fest tour is about. And it's kind of crazy and very interesting to see the progression of their relationship being two highly competitive opponents in multiple back-to-back final series, all of a sudden just gain this. Maybe they've always had this respect for each other, but clearly it's a more open affinity for each other, almost like gushingly so. And so it's nice to see that kind of manifest itself not only on the court, but also off the court as well, as they continue to embrace each other and, I don't know, retweet each other on their Snapchats or Instagram posts, who knows? All I know is that it was fun and it helped us get through a very stagnant Lakers offseason in which nothing happened. So there you go. Raj, thank you so much for hopping on.
Jonathan, before we go, can we do two minutes? Because on the entrance, on my intro, you mentioned Jalen Hood-Schifino. And I just like, I want to do this for the Lakers Legacy, you know, podcast listeners, because I've been heralded as a JHS stan. And that's not what I am at all. I put context, as you mentioned earlier, I try to stay level-headed. I feel like every time we draft a project and they become a project, we ask why they're not, you know, they're not producing like a first round pick. So I just want to kind of mention, do 2 minutes really quickly. JHS in the G League. I know that's it's G League, but I just like to mention this because I think it's an actual place where basketball is played. I was at most of the games that he played there. He averaged 22 on 5 assists. He shot 43% on threes on 5 pull-up threes a game in 15 games. Now, this is all contingent on him being able to create separation at the next level, right? This is all contingent on. But I think the idea that a 20-year-old guard who's 6'5", 6'10 wingspan is a bust because he played like 20 total minutes and Darvin Ham threw him out at the strangest times. And it was like, it would be the middle of a game and like it's a close game and like JHS is out there. And everyone's like, JHS sucks. Like, why is he out there? He should not. So, like, I just want to put context into kind of his season ago. Spoke to him after one of the games. He said, like, I was injured all year. I had back surgery super early. And that's a thing that you don't really recover from. So I just want to put that out there. I'm not a JHS stan. I just try to put context on, like, why I believe a 20-year-old guard is not a bust because they played, like, 30 minutes in the league. And I wish – and if people don't watch the G League, I think that's fine. It's funny because going into summer league, I was like, oh, I can't wait to watch Maxwell Lewis. I was like, I like Maxwell Lewis, but he's like a year behind JHS. Like people, and he struggled, you know, in the summer league as I thought he would. I still have high hopes on him, but yeah, JHS was our first round pick. And I think first round picks are important. We just went through a whole spiel, Jonathan, about why we should not move a 2029 first round pick. Our 2023 first round pick is sitting on our bench and he was not mentioned really at all through this. So I just think it's important to kind of keep context that the kid is 20 years old. Give him some time. He might not be an NBA player. I just don't know the answer to that yet. And so I'll put that out.
Well, you know, I'm glad you came full circle with this because at the top, I praised you for being someone who contextualizes things and doesn't go towards the hot takes, clickbaity stuff. I unfortunately, for some reason, JHS has brought the worst out of me, because typically I am you. You remind me of a young version of myself defending D'Angelo Russell at age 18 or 19 or whatever. Right. And everything you're saying makes a lot of sense in my head. But mm-hmm. in my heart, I'm like, I don't know that this guy is an NBA player. But having said that, I cannot ignore the fact that everything you said is correct with regards to his injury, the awkward context he was put in. The only thing I would add on top of that is I feel like the Lakers put him in this awkward context by drafting him, because I don't think they assessed his player profile adequately enough with the timeline they were in, because he's a player who needs reps and a player who needs the ball. The reason why he's able to score 22 points and hit like 40% from three in the G League is because he has the ability to find energy with the ball off those dribbles and step back and sidestep into those threes and gain that rhythm. Whereas on the Lakers, he's going to need to be comfortable just camping out on the baseline and waiting for that pass to come, you know? So it's unfortunate that not only did he not get the reps G League wise because he was injured, or even just like on the Lakers big team, but he also might not get the reps even if he is healthy, because, you know, the Lakers are built the way they're built. But I will say, if JHS is healthy and he's able to show something, he could be another, you know, quote unquote key sort of player that allows the Lakers to sort of, you know, move on from a Gabe Vincent as well. And, you know, siphon in more of those minutes and usage to JHS to see what they have, because they need to see what they have in this guy quick, because technically he's an expiring contract next season. I don't know if people realize that. His next 2 years after this season are club options. So if a team wants him, they may just want him because he's expiring. And usually when you trade for former first round picks or recent former first round picks, you're trading for them because they're on a cheap deal. But a team might just trade for JHS because they're like, oh, that's $3.8 million coming off the books next year. So
That's totally fair. And I think we obviously have, you know, short memories. The reason that they did, and again, it's a wrong decision. Like, they should have drafted Jaime Jaquez. They should have drafted Brandon Podziemski. Like, those guys are legit better now, would have helped this season. The reason they didn't is because they're like, hey, we have a stacked roster. We have 14 playable dudes, right? And I think this was before even Christian Wood signed. I don't remember the exact timing of this. So, like, yeah, like, our scouting department has a very reputable reputation, right? Like, they're very, like, people love the scouting department, and we're like, hey, let's let our scouts pick a project, you know, let them pick one that they liked. And like, there's some confusion on if this was Rob's pick or not. I'm not in the room, so I don't know, but I think that was the thinking, was like, this player's not going to play anyway, let them build. What's the wrong decision? I'm just saying, well, so far I'll give everyone that's the wrong decision. I think like, throwing a 20-year-old guard under, and like, it, anytime I even tweet a clip about JHS, all the answers are like, you know, very much in the worst part of us. So I just hope that, and not playing summer league obviously really compounded this issue. But I'm hopeful that, you know, he gets a healthy season and actually gets to show if he's a bust or not, because I have no idea. Didn't get to see it.
Well, It behooves Lakers fans and the Lakers in general for JHS to be good or show something, you know? So, right. I mean, 100%. To your point, where was I going to go with this? Yeah, I mean, I lost my train of thought with JHS. He also brings out the worst of me. But yeah, with regards to everything you said on JHS, I think all of your points are well taken. And I think he will be a good test case for just how well the Lakers are building out their player development side of things and their culture, because if they can rebound and rebuild his confidence and his value, then clearly we're on the right track and doing something right. So hopefully we begin to see that from JHS as early as this upcoming season. So Raj, thank you so much for hopping on and spending almost like an hour and a half. I might have to break this up into two episodes. I don't know. we'll see where it goes. But I'm glad that we were able to just chop it up about literally... We ran the gamut of all Lakers topics, from Steph Curry to JHS to Max Christie starting at the three. So, but that's what you get when you get two Lakers heads on a podcast together. And appreciate you for hopping on. If you want to plug anything or anything you're working on, please do so. I know you've been doing some WNBA coverage, which is really awesome to see. But Raj, thank you for hopping on the Lakers Legacy Podcast.
Of course, man. It's an honor. Long time listener. So it's great to finally be on. Yeah, just follow me at Raj Chapalu on Twitter. I have Lakers Detailed Pod I do with my guy Vinay, and then the Lakers Lounge with Anthony. And then, yeah, I just got approved, got my credential approved for the Sparks, which has been really cool to go. And I went and watched Sabrina Ionescu warm up, which was just a really cool experience to be there up front and watch her kind of work. And I would really, you know, tell anyone who lives in the LA area, go out to a Sparks game, very affordable. You could sit super close and, you know, all the stars come in and it's a cool game and a cool league that's really building. So, yeah, Jonathan, thank you, man. This was awesome.
Absolutely. We'll have to do it again. Raj, take some time to get some rest because you know what's coming for us once the Lakers season starts.
Yes.
September is coming up. We have to mentally prepare ourselves for this season. I know I do, but it'll be fun to converse with you as we go on this trek and see if the Lakers are ever going to make a trade or a new move or not. But with that said, Raj, thank you so much for hopping on, and I will catch you later.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.